5 days before her 30th birthday, on August 24, 1986, Toni Gustas was out on her patio. It was a Sunday, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and Gustas was in a t-shirt working on some plants. She had just moved to Massachusetts from Iowa. The only contact she had in town was a person who had hired her for a job at the United Way in Framingham. She had found a small two-bedroom basement apartment with a living room that opened onto a sunken patio. When she stood on the patio, the street came up to her chest. A man strolled by and asked for directions. His eyes seemed glassy and his speech was slurred. Gustas did not know how to direct the man, but her Midwestern upbringing kept her from giving a curt answer and turning away. She told him she was new in town and unsure of the local geography. She pointed him in a direction she thought might be helpful. The man did not turn away. He took another step toward the patio and asked if a different street could take him to the same place. She told him what she knew, but she was starting to feel uncomfortable. It was as if they were suddenly having a conversation. The man took another step to the edge of the patio. Gustas told the man she had to go inside. She turned, and he jumped down onto the patio. He grabbed her arm. She raised her voice immediately and told him to leave. He asked for a glass of water. Gustas could smell alcohol on his breath. She protested, and he started to shove her back into the apartment. A driver in a passing car saw a man and a woman having what seemed to be an altercation on a patio. The driver went to the corner, turned around, and came back for another look. By the time the car got back to the spot, the patio was empty. The driver moved on. The intruder was not much taller than Gustas. She was about 5'5", and he may have been 5'9" or 5'10", but he was considerably stronger. The moment he shoved her into the apartment, she started fighting. She screamed, and he clamped a hand over her mouth. He was carrying a portable music player, and Gustas seized the headphones cord and wound it around his neck. He seized her throat. They struggled, trying to subdue each other, until Gustas felt she was going to pass out. Something more primal than fear kicked in. Gustas let go of the headphones cord and went passive. It wasn't just that he was stronger. He was so drunk that she feared he might asphyxiate her and not even know it. No matter what happened, she wanted to get out alive. The moment he started removing her clothes, another instinct kicked in. Gustas started to memorize details about the man. He was white and in his early 20s. He had a little black cross on one arm that may have been ink or may have been a tattoo. He had dark blonde hair that fell over his forehead and his ears. His hair was parted in the middle. His nose was long in proportion to his face. His eyes were blue and relatively narrow. He had a tapered jaw. On and on she went, looking for distinctive features. She swore to herself, "I am not going to forget this face." After he raped her, the man allowed her to dress. He put on his clothes. He was not done. It appeared he wanted to have a conversation. Gustas could not believe he wanted small talk. In a sympathetic voice, he told her that sometimes it is not good for women when it is like this. Gustas was stunned. He had no idea what he had just done. He was subdued for now, but who knew how long it would last? Screaming for help was out of the question. She had tried that, and no one had responded. She had to get out of the apartment. Calmly keeping up her end of the small talk, she told the rapist she needed a glass of water from the kitchen. She asked if he wanted a glass too. He did nothing to stop her from walking out of the living room. The door to the apartment was next to the kitchen, and Gustas simply opened the door and kept walking. A strange calm descended upon her. She knew what she had to do. From a drugstore, she called her boss and told him what had happened. He drove by, picked her up, and took her to the police station. Police officers administered a rape kit and immediately asked Gustas to tell them everything distinctive about the rapist. Gustas unloaded every detail she had memorized about the man, the nose, the chin, the eyes, the hair. The man had been wearing a blue and white shirt a blue windbreaker, and jeans. An artist came up with a composite picture that Gusta thought was fairly accurate. She told the police the man's voice was slurred, but she was good with voices and had memorized how he sounded. By the time the police arrived at the crime scene, the rapist was gone, but he had left his windbreaker behind. There was a burrito wrapped in plastic and foil inside one pocket. Police officers traced it to a convenience store. There was a black and white film security camera in the store, and the police showed Gustus the grainy video. She recognized the rapist the moment she saw him, even though the tape did not show his face. Gustus had memorized the man's body language, the way he carried himself. The police showed her photos of a number of possible suspects and pictures from local high school yearbooks. None of the photos matched the rapist. About a month after the crime, the police asked Gustus if a drifter they had picked up was the man. Gustus said no. In early December, the police picked up a man who matched the composite picture. Late one evening, police detectives brought Gustus a set of 15 photos. Gustus pointed to the photo of the man the police had picked up, but she said she needed to see him before she could be sure. Through a one-way mirror at the police station, Gustus thought she saw the rapist. She was cautious by nature and asked if she could hear the man's voice. The police held a door ajar so Gustus could hear the suspect speak. Gustus told the police she was 95% sure that the man in custody was the rapist. His name, she learned, was Eric Sarsfield.